Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Windgap. There's a murder there. Another one's missing now. Get me a story.
Bad Mama, goodness, I didn't expect you. The house is not up to par for visitors. I'm just in town on business.
What kind of person does that? Hurt a child.
Doesn't help anything. Riling folks up.
You got two mutilated girls on your hands. Someone else is doing the riling.
I didn't come back to cause any problems. Everything you do comes back on me.
Mama says I need to be careful around you.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Sharp Objects, an unofficial podcast about the HBO series Sharp Objects. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week we break down the latest episode and occasionally feature interviews with people who worked on the show. This week we will be chatting with actress Eliza Scanlon, who plays Amma. Don't be fooled by her Australian accent. That is indeed Amma. You will hear later in this episode. And then at the end of this episode, we'll be diving into a spoiler section for book readers. We like to queue up, what is it, Richard? Some Tupac and hog noises?
Yeah, you know, as the mashup that was always meant to be.
The mashup that was promised. You will hear that before you hear any book spoilers for us. So that's your cue to frantically turn off your podcast.
And we are serious about spoilers. We will yes. Spoil everything.
Everything whole will
hog.
Be spoiled.
What is it? Nose
whole
to tail?
Hog. Yeah, nose to tail, whole hog. Wow, I can't believe
it took us six episodes to get there.
Okay. Before we get to any of that, we are going to take a spoiler-free look at episode 6, titled Cherry, directed by Jean-Marc Vallée and written by Ariella Bleger and Don Kamosh. We got a few emails this week. The main correction that people wanted to make sure that we registered, and we did. And thank you, by the way, for being so nice in your corrections this week, was that we mistakenly said, identified Camille talking in the dressing room, in last week's episode saying, we said you were there at the end is something that she said to her mom, Adora. In fact, she said you weren't there at the end. So that's just a tiny mistake that we made, but otherwise, pretty solid.
Good for us.
And then we got a really, really very long and very personal email from a listener who wished to remain anonymous. I'm not going to read the whole thing, because as I said, it's very long, but I think it sort of reflects on one particular scene in this episode, episode 6, Cherry. So I thought that I would just dip into it a little bit in the middle. This listener writes in, there's a great quote by F. Scott Fitzgerald that talks about the value of being able to hold two opposite ideas in your mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. This is one of those moments. This being what the listener is referring to is the way in which Camille thinks about what happened to the Woods when she was a teenager with those boys from the football team. Camille feels what happened in the forest was a choice she made and she's okay with it. Also, it's not something those boys should have done. You have to be able to recognize that two things can be true at the same time, but then it becomes very difficult to talk about. How do you refer to that incident? I honestly don't know. Stating it in one way invalidates the feelings that Camille has and robs her of her agency, but referring to it the way Camille would prefer feels to me like you're letting those boys get away with something they did that was wrong. I don't have an answer here, but I do think the show is being very smart about this by letting Detective Dick voice his perspective, but also by letting Camille voice hers. Visually, I think the show is with Detective Dick. The way those forest scenes are shot is not a neutral look at that incident, but the show doesn't seem to be disagreeing with Camille's perspective either. It's an incredibly nuanced thing, and we live in a world that is leaving less and less room for nuance, so I think it's actually very brave what they are doing.
Yeah, thank you to that reader for that email, and I think it was really insightful and really gets at a really crucial conversation in this episode that we'll talk about between Camille and one of the boys who was there.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, thank you so much for the email and all the other things that were in it. I really appreciate it. And you can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I've been accused of saying that too quickly, so let me say it slowly. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, any of your...
Which you already had before we started this podcast because you had all that fan fiction you'd written about Pod from Game of Thrones.
Yeah, my Podrick Payne fanfic.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So that's just a little behind-the-scenes gossip for you guys.
If you want to send me your Podrick Payne fanfic, you can send it to me at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We are always watching pods.
Because who knows? Maybe in the future this podcast will talk about Game of Thrones. You never know.
Who knows? You never know. All right. So we start this episode. We hop a little bit back. You know, it's sort of, or it seems to me to maybe be Camille dreaming about running through the woods, trying to find Emma. And as she's running through in her white dress, looking for Emma, in Emma's white dress, she sees all the other dead girls in their white dresses or nightgowns in the forest. And to quote Jackie later in the episode, dead girls everywhere. And then she, you know, she has like a couple dreams and then she wakes up in Detective Dick's motel room. She is fully clothed. He is naked as we left them last week. What do you think of this opener?
Didn't mind that shot. I'll tell you that. There were worse things to wake up next to. Yeah, I think that, like, the way that they've pitched this relationship, if we want to call it that, I think is really subtle, where, like, he's clearly like, why is she still wearing her clothes? But also had fun and kind of wants her to come back. And she's like, I have all these deep, dark secrets. But she's also, like, not, like, rigid and sort of, like, completely closed off for him. Like, they're interacting the way that people with secrets and curiosities would interact with each other because they still like each other.
I like, you know, she's tense. She's looking for an insult when he's not insulting her or whatever, you know, when she's like, you know, you're halfway to a question you wanted to ask. And like, she's, the episode bears out that she's kind of right because he does have these questions about her that he doesn't ask her. But she also is digging for questions and accusations where he's just in, you know, in other contexts, just making conversation. And I like that tenseness in her, but as you say, it's sort of softened by like a smile and a kiss from her as well. And so like, it's not a full shutdown, but it's like the sort of tentative approach that we would expect from Camille, who never like sleeps with people.
Yeah.
You know?
And I just want to put on record that if Chris Messina is listening to this and wants to give me a flannel, I'll happily take it.
Will you eat pasta in bed with Chris Messina too?
No, that's too far.
Okay. That's a bolognese too far.
I saved right, that so. for Jon Favreau. Thank you.
Oh, Favs only. Thank you. All right. So then we see Vickery waking up and we see again his morning routine.
Just a little more clipped, a little quicker this time.
Yeah, but still, like, the acknowledgement of the cross, the Patsy, like, I guess it's Patsy Cline every morning, 24/7 in the Vickery household. His poor, suffering wife, still making his breakfast. And then we see, this is my favorite piece of information we get in this, like, hugely packed episode full of so much information, which is where Alan sleeps and how he chooses to relax. Richard, what did you think of Alan's little arrangement?
In this big old house, there's not a proper guest bedroom. He has to fold. I mean, not to say that a fold-out couch in a room is not a guest bedroom, but, like, you know what I mean? Like, an established bed.
So I was talking to someone, a friend of mine, about this. I was like, what is with Alan on the pullout? And she was like, well, if he has his own room, that makes it, like, too real. It makes the arrangement too real. I think, like, Adora, for appearances, doesn't want Alan to have his own room. You know what I mean? Yeah. I agree with you. That was my first instinct. And I was like, why is he sleeping in his study when, like, there's so many houses, rooms in that house? But she was like, Adora does not want people to see Alan have his own room. The other thing that I am inferring from this scene is that Alan jerks off to record covers, which is my favorite thing in the whole world. It's so beautiful. And that I have to imagine is like, I have to imagine that Jean-Marc Vallée, because it's Jean-Marc Vallée's idea for Alan to like have all this music. Like that's Jean-Marc did this great interview, with Alan Sepinwall over Rolling Stone this week where he talked about, the three DJs of the show are Alan, Emma, and, Camille, via Alice, right? And so it's his idea for Alan to have all these records. So I have to imagine that it's his idea to be like, oh, and also, you know, he does other things with his records. So there you go.
Another little character detail for good old Alan.
Good on with his crisp white pants. All right. So then Adora wakes up to a call and she says, don't do a thing till I get there, which we find out what that is later. And then we have this really interesting scene with Camille eating some cherry pie in the kitchen.
Like, voraciously.
What did you think of?
I mean, image-wise, it was like, pretty interesting, you know, in that, like, it approached gore, you know, and the crust approached flesh, you know, and you think about all the hogs and the processing and dead bodies and, you know, it's a pretty like visceral food to eat in this world. But also the cherry aspect of it comes into play later in a beautiful scene with one of her old cheerleading teammates. I think that it's interesting that Adora says, don't let me interrupt your breakfast. It's the first I've seen you eat since you've been here. And there's something mothering about that. You know, coming right off of this, you know, miserable conversation on the porch about how she never loved Camille, there is this kind of, I don't know what it is, if it's calculated or if it's knee-jerk kind of, you know, tenderness, a care.
Yeah, it's interesting. I also took it as, I don't have any evidence for this, and I can't remember any evidence in the text for this, but this exchange and then the flashback that she has struck me as like maybe there's some disordered eating with Camille as well. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, she says, this is the first time I've seen you eat. And then Camille has this memory of like, as a kid, bopping into the kitchen in her like little her first cheerleader uniform, because it's not her like high school cheerleader uniform. So I guess like as a middle school cheerleader. And then Marion says something like, you know, doesn't she look like you just take a bite out of her? And then, and then Adora calls her, you know, a plump, juicy cherry. And then, like, young Camille looks put off by that. Mm-hmm. And so to me, like, and this is no comment at all on, like, the actress Sophia Lillis or anything like that. Like, to me, Adora definitely seems like the kind of mother who would, like, make a child who is not overweight feel overweight anyway. Way that she would comment on how she looked. And so her use of, like, plump in that context made me feel like that would give Camille some issues around her body and food around her mother. So, but that's like something that they just like lightly touch on and they don't dive into. And so maybe I'm reading too much into it, or it's just something that they decide to sort of just lightly dust over, in here. And then you have this like shot of Camille going over the sink and she's hugging Gayla, the family maid, in like the exact same way that Emma did her little like Tupac dance with Adora. Yeah. But like this is the closest Camille gets to like motherly affection, you know. Really.
Yeah, and Gayla, you know, responds with an affectionate kind of pat or arm rub, and it's a sweet moment, but it's a lonely one too for both women.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I knew a family growing up who had a live-in nanny / maid for many years, and that's an interesting relationship. It's a complicated relationship, you know, with a kind of really fraught power dynamic. So I thought that was a sweet little moment, but also kind of ringed with sadness.
Yeah, because it's not quite, you know, I think you see this sometimes in fiction where I think it's a trope that you have like the rich but distant parents and then the like nanny who's effectively like the mother, you know what I mean? But that's not quite the relationship she has with Gayla, because Gayla still seems like firmly team Team Adora. She's Team Chameleon, Team Adora. Like, she's neutral, I guess, is what I would say. Because, like, she knows that Adora is her employer. And there was that, there's that scene, a flashback in an earlier episode where, like, Gala is in Adora's room and, like, Adora kisses Gala, like, gives her a kiss, like, offers her way more affection than she ever offered her own daughter, Camille. And, like, so Gala is, like, allowed in the inner sanctum, allowed this sort of stuff. And I think, you know, given her preference, Gala would choose Camille over Adora, but she also, like, is cognizant of who pays her. So it's...
Yeah, this isn't the help, unfortunately. It's not, you know...
Right. So, right.
Like, Hilly Holbrook getting told off, yeah, so it's, I mean, and I think that, you know, yet another example of this show presented with an obvious character dynamic and then going a different direction, a more subtle direction.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, holding multiple truths at once.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get this scene with Emma and Camille in Emma's room, and Emma is, like, sort of joking about cutting, which is not funny, my friend. And, you know, just sort of is off to do teenage substance abuse things, and Camille is sort of cautioning her. Did anything strike you about this exchange?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, again, with this sort of, this protectiveness, like, there are a couple moments in this episode, but there's this moment, and then there's Camille talking to Emma about the drinking. You know, she's like, you know, you've been, you know, after last night, you should take it easy. I mean, you know, far be it from you to take advice from me about partying or whatever. Where Camille has this kind of self-awareness about herself, obviously, that's almost like she uses it in a friendly kind of nurturing way. And yet clearly, interiorly, sort of loathes herself and loathes the things that are problems with herself, you know? So I just find it interesting how she's able to outwardly, almost like, you know, not benefit from these experiences, but sort of like turn them into good things in terms of like extending care to other people, and yet cannot do that to herself at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I was interested by the, I haven't taken like a really close look at Emma's room yet. But I was, you know, I talked to Eliza for this episode, the actress who plays Emma. But in another interview I read, she talked about how like she came from the world of Australian soaps and came directly to this like prestige HBO drama. And she's like, I'm used to the sets where like the bed is just like a comforter over like a cardboard box, basically. She's like, but this is so detailed. And so, I don't know. It's just Emma has all this stuff in her room that, you know, the more obsessive watchers might want to like take a closer look at some of the, what Emma gathers around herself. And then we get, okay, first of a couple scenes with still my favorite character.
Yeah.
A wild Jackie appears down an alleyway. This is not a scene in the book, so I wasn't like sure it was for a split second. Then I was like, oh no, that's a caftan I spy in the distance. Yeah. It's definitely
caftan
Jackie.
Caftan in the alleyway.
the Jackie story. Yeah, and she's tossing either old flowers or just tossing the roses, that are at the site where Natalie Keene's body is found and replacing them with daisies, it seems like. And, does that strike you as a fun thing to do in this town? What do you think of Jackie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, she said why she did it, because there's something more girlish and young, youthful about a daisy, you know, and also the roses are so closely associated with Adora. And like, you know, I thought it was, and I think that doesn't Dick say like, that's a nice thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like, yeah, I think that Jackie reveals multiple shades of herself in this episode. Here is a sort of, you know, this kind of almost like ghostly image of Jackie, like moving through town in her billowy caftan, like fixing things and like changing things. But then later in the episode, we see a little bit of a more weather beaten kind of darker side of her.
Right. And this is sober Jackie. This is sober light of day Jackie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she also says, And then I get disappointed in Detective Dick, right? Because like, so in last week's episode, Adora brings him into the house and she definitely tries to like plant some like seeds of doubt in him about Camille. And she drops these hints about Camille and says she's fragile. And then he walks out of there and Camille's like so freaked out. And she's like, what did she tell you? And he's like, oh, I know so much about that floor, you know? And then you're like, yeah, Dick, yeah, you're on her team. It's great. And then he lets Adora's work on him in this episode.
Yeah.
And he starts asking questions about Camille, starting with Jackie. And like, I think Jackie also looks disappointed in him. And,
she doesn't discourage him exactly, but she does seem like, oh, like that's who you are, you know?
Yeah, not exactly. But later she says, don't believe everything you hear.
Right.
Something that she says later. So
right.
I think that, you know, that she's, but like Jackie, there's that great shot in last week's episode where we see Jackie see Adora take Dick into the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, you know, just, I'm just convinced Jackie knows every single little thing, everything. And she's, you know, to that vein, she says, you're getting warmer, detective, when he's asking about, you know, Camille and Adora and all of that. So, what that means, we will leave for the spoiler section. And, I will end by saying I am extremely disappointed in Dick for calling his colleague and asking him to run a background check on Camille, basically.
Yet another reason to be disappointed in Dick.
There's something that Messina said, Chris Messina said in last week's episode when I was talking to him. He says something about Dick starts to investigate Camille. And I actually didn't quite know what he meant at the time, because it's not quite a book thing that happens. And so, I was like, oh, when this episode, I was like, oh, I understand what he meant. I thought he meant sort of like emotionally, but he meant like literally call it a background check on her. So, that's not a delightful thing. And then we hop over the farm. And they're pulling this bike out of the muck on the hog farm. And the gang's all here. And by the gang, I mean Bob Nash, Vickery, Detective Dick, and Adora. What did you think of
Well, I didn't realize that it was pig shit, which we find out later. I thought it was just mud.
Yeah.
And then, no, it's not. But yeah, certainly, like, the most concrete thing for the present tense case at hand that we've gotten in a while, right?
Absolutely. It's a huge piece of evidence, I would say.
Yeah.
And I'm super curious about it. What I think is an interesting detail, you know, Bob says he could identify the bike by the flowers on the seat, and I think they were daisies if my eyes did not deceive me. And that so that means, you know, that Jackie was right about little girls and their fondness for daisies. So,
or Jackie's the killer.
Or Jackie is the killer. But yeah, I like this scene, and I like, you know, what we figure out from the scene is that, you know, the call that Adora got was like, I guess, I don't know, we see some handlebar sticking out of the pig shit or something like that. And she's like, cool, don't do anything till I get there. And then we realize that this is why she didn't want Camille with her and all this sort of stuff, as she was sort of trying to control and manage the whole situation.
And she later refers to it as a business matter, you know, which could, yes, because it technically is on her business's property, but like, it's a murder investigation of a teenage girl. Like, I feel like it's pretty cold language to describe what that is.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know that, I can't see any way in which Adora would let Camille come with her.
Yeah.
But I guess she could have been more honest about why she doesn't want her with her.
Yeah.
It's also interesting what, Adora decided to wear to, like, you know, dredge the pig shit, which is like these cream pants. They're not as white as Alan's crisp white pants, but they are like very deeply impractical for pulling a bike out of the muck. So there you go. And then Dick, you know, everyone on the case wants employment records for all the hog farm employees. And then we cut to, John at the pool, and this whole scene with, Emma and her girls. And, this is something that like maybe isn't as clear in the show or whatever, but like, yeah. So Ashley and Emma's friend Jodes, shut the fuck up, Jodes, are sisters. So Emma is over hanging out there and John is like staying in their pool house.
Yeah. Despite the continued antagonism and or antagonizing of John by these girls, they still have access to, like, his world. I mean, obviously, because it's a small town, but because of the Jodes connection, which is a great 70s thriller starring Gene Hackman, if you... or at least it should have been.
So, yeah, so Emma, the girls, John are all hanging out by the pool, and, like, I gotta admit that John is saying some, like... I mean, Emma is being... intentionally provocative in every sense of the word. She's giving some hardcore Lolita vibes. And, like, what I will say about this interaction is, like, I watched this episode multiple times, and watching this pool scene after watching the scene at the end where Emma talks about, like, boys are easy. You just, like, you know, the way to interact with boys is sexual control. That helps this, that illuminates this pool scene for me. That thing she says at the end, but, like, the way in which John is talking to her is, like, super weird. He's like, you know, he says, it'll be your day soon, and all this sort of weird, ominous shit. So,
yeah. And like, we see him with his shirt off, and he has a tattoo, and he's smoking a cigarette. It's like kind of a different angle on him than we've seen before. You know, there's a menace to it. That, like, he previously was this kind of brooding, sorrowful, mourning kid, and now he had a different bearing about him. And I have to say, like, this scene, I've seen it twice now. This scene is so beautifully staged in terms of the blocking, and, the sound work is incredible with, you know, the cicadas and the slight murmur of the pool and just the feeling of the heat in the air and that sexual charge that, like, you know, is a part of teenage summer. You know, it's kind of illicit. It's kind of grungy. I just thought this scene was so beautifully done. I mean, the whole show is, but, like, this scene for me, like, was a really perfect example of the subtle but really complicated stuff that Valet, is doing.
Yeah. The sound design is amazing. He, in that interview with Alan Sepinwall, on Rolling Stone, he talked about how they captured the place, the time in the shooting that they captured the best bug noises. You know, the best bug noises was episode 4, the first scene where, like, Camille is rooting around in the grass for the iPhone that she threw. And he was like, we got the perfect bug noises. He's like, and then we just used that as the background track for the rest of the show. And we just, like, turned it up full blast sometimes, or turned it down, or whatever it was. But, like, those cicadas are just going the whole time.
Yeah. And just that feeling of, like, a baking summer afternoon by, like, a pool, like, all that concrete or, you know, whatever it is surrounding the pool, and just that charge in the air, that's kind of sleazy but, like, really alluring. Like, I just, something about it really clicked for me, and I really got where these kids were.
Yeah, like, you could practically smell the chlorine, is what I would say.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there's a shot in this scene, you know, because, like, Camille rolls up, she's listening to John be, like, super weird to her sister, she's listening to her sister being absolutely terrible, as per usual. And then there's this, like, closing moment where Emma dips her head down into the pool, and, like, to me, it felt reflective of, in the first episode, we see young Camille sort of dip her head into the lake that she's swimming in. But I'm trying to not do that thing where I spoil our own interview, but I did ask Eliza Scanlon about this, and she said, because that shot was used in all the trailers, and I really liked it, and she said that, that Jean-Marc Vallée wanted it to be her Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now moment. And I was like, well, I love that. So, that's Martin Sheen in the, like, you know, mucky waters of Vietnam, you know, moment for this beautiful blonde teenage girl. So, and then we get, Chris Messina in the interview last week talked about, like, how much work the actors have to do as background, just for other people's shots. And I was thinking about that in this scene where Ashley is talking to Camille, you know, our fave. Ashley is back. She's the best. And the girls still have to just be, like, sitting poolside in soft focus in the background behind Camille while she's talking. And I was just like, those girls just had to sit out there in the sun while she did this. And I bet you it was the real girls and not some stand-ins. And, anyway.
Yeah, well, commitment to
the
cause.
I guess so. Yeah. I guess sitting poolside is not the worst thing that you could do for your job. But anyway, I love this exchange where Ashley is completely lying and Camille gives her this, like, great look. Amy Adams just, like, it's this, like, fuck you smile. It's like,
yeah.
Great. great. Thanks for bringing me out here and wasting my time. Cause Ashley is like, oh, you know, God plucked angels from Wind Gap and they were just the best girls. And Camille's like, no, I know that they were holy terrors. So what are you saying? What did you think of this little bit of, journalistic, integrity from Camille?
Yeah, I liked Camille, like, not suffering any bullshit from Ashley. This is a tiny little inside baseball detail, but I love that they included the little beep of her turning on and off the recorder. You and I, as people who use those a lot to interview people, I had like a kind of, not in a great way, Pavlovian response to that sound of like, oh my God, I'm at work, or like, I'm in a scary interview or something. And yeah, Amy Adams, so good. Like, just that turn, that sort of shift. But then, you know, Camille waits a beat or half a beat because she knows that Ashley will scramble and come up with something approaching real to like stay in the moment. And she does, sort of. I mean, she offers a little bit more of a window into John's character.
Yeah, this idea of like whoever, in Ashley's view, whoever the killer is, they're doing it for popularity.
But that's such an Ashley thing.
It really is. Classic Ash.
Classic Ash.
We also see her turn her head and it looks like she's got a little chunk taken out of her ear, which is a grisly little sight. I also had a Pavlovian response to the sound of the recorder, but for me, it's that, I don't know if you feel this way, but I'm always, whenever I use the recorder, I'm always paranoid that it's going to like stop recording in the middle of the conversation. I'm always.
Yes. Cause it's happened to me.
It happens not all the time, but it happens. And when it happens, it's so bad. And so you're just always like, I'm always just like darting a glance down to make sure it's still recording and stuff like that. So the sound of the beep, I was like, is it? Exactly. Is she going to say something while the recorder's off? Oh no. Anyway, so, and then, you know, Ashley asks if Camille, misses being a cheerleader, and we get this flashback to Camille with the cheer squad around her. And I really like that, you know, we'll get the grown-up cheerleaders later, but I really like that they introduce this here. So that it's not just like she's triggered by the grown-up cheerleader. She's triggered actually by Ashley to remember it, which I think is kind of fun. But she's like, you know, Ashley has this whole thing of like, this is what I envisioned for you. You'd have a beautiful house and an iBanker husband. And I think she says like a couple curly tops running around. And Camille's like, yeah, no thanks. It's this really interesting scene that she flashes back to where, this character named Becca, is massaging like a cramp out of her leg. And we find out later that Becca like notices, you know, a cut on the back of Camille's leg and blood is trickling down. Before we find out what it actually is, like just that memory taking it on its surface, which could be like, oh, someone got their period. A teenage girl got her period when she didn't want or expect it. That's a mortifying memory that a lot of teenage girls have. We know that there's like something.
Yeah, I mean, what we see it most famously in that 70s teen comedy Carrie.
What a blast. Sissy Spacek. Comedy phenom, Sissy Spacek.
What a good time.
That's so funny. I should think about Carrie's mom and Adora more closely.
I think that something interesting about this scene, this flashback, and then what comes later in the episode is, you know, the Becca presence, and a viewer might sort of like subtextually be like, oh, it's interesting that the one black girl on the team is the one kind of doing the massaging. Okay. And then move on. But then the show, because Valet never forgets and the writers never forget anything, of course it comes back up later in the episode. And I think this is kind of really the first time the show has grappled with race beyond the Civil War stuff, but like actually in the immediate sort of present day and you know, recent past. It's another sort of interesting variable to bring into the town, and particularly how the young people in the town socialize.
I'm so glad you brought this up because, you know, we've had the Confederate flag imagery. We've had this discussion on this podcast about whether or not Missouri actually is the South. We had like great emails about it and stuff like that. The character that, you know, this character of Becca is not quite the same in the book. And there is a character that Camille sort of bonds with at this, you know, girls' night that she goes to, but it's not a woman of color. And so like the fact that they made her otherness, I would say because she's a woman of color. I think that's the implication in this episode, that she was treated differently because of that way. You know, Camille's like, we treated you like shit. And there's like, seems to be a reason why, she's treated like shit. I think it's not the show grappling with race, on the large scale, but it is the show, you know, getting into it in a way that the book doesn't. And I think that that's really interesting. So.
Yeah. And I think also it's a good reminder, and the actress who plays her, Hilary Ward, who she plays Becca as an adult, it does this beautifully in her few scenes in the episode. It's a reminder that, you know, while Camille has got her shit, she's by no means the only person who this town is sort of conspiring to smother. You know, and to in subtle ways, in profound ways. You know, there are other people in the town suffering. It might be hard, I guess, in a way for Camille to see that. I mean, obviously the two murdered girls suffered, but like, you know, watching the show, you can very much be the sort of like Camille versus the world thing. Or Camille at least versus Windgap. But other people, you know, are harmed by its mechanisms too.
Right. And the way in which that Camille feels like such an other and such an outsider, but like, in fact, has a golden ticket to the town because she still is like Adora's daughter and beautiful and like all these other things that the town prizes. And the way in which she is an outsider is self-inflicted in a way. And that's not like, to say it's bad, because like I would prefer to be an outsider. I would prefer to not be comfortable in Windgap, but like that it is something that Camille has, a path she's chosen for herself, where some people don't even have that choice. They're just othered anyway, you know? So,
yeah.
So before we get to like, you know, the more stuff about grown up Becca, we've got a great, great Adora on the porch moment, where like after Dick has called Camille, suggests they have pasta in bed, which, as you said, is something you would only do with Jon Favreau. Then he tells her that, oh yeah, we found the bike thanks to your mom, and Camille is pissed because she feels like her mom kept her outside of this scoop. And she comes home, she parks her Volvo a little bit too much on the lawn, and
like one tire.
Oh my God, it's
like a little, like, bit, yeah.
Not even the lawn is safe for her. It's like such a good line. Yeah. And then Alan's like, should we say something? And she goes, why cause a scene? I mean, it's just like pearls, diamonds and pearls and gems are falling from Patricia Clarkson's mouth as she's doing this scene. It's so good. You know, and then, she comes up and she's sort of confronting Adora, and Adora gives this like, just, are you interviewing me? Like, reaction. And it's just, it's so good. And then, you know, Camille storms in and Adora, you know, basically says she's outstayed her welcome. And Alan's like, you've been more than tolerant. And then she goes, tell her how you feel about it. Like, it's just all, these beautiful strings that Adora is pulling. And, meanwhile, her nails, which are blood red, are just like sort of glinting like talons in the sun. And it's just, this is one of my favorite scenes in an episode that's just like full of so many good scenes. What did you think of all of this?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's another funny, but also, you know, grim look at the way that she runs her household. And also we knew this was coming. We knew that it's eventually Adora was going to be like, we got to get her out of here, you right. know? So here it is. Well, the beginnings of it anyway. And it's just imagine your mom saying that, you know, or, you know, a loved one saying that about you. Like, I think they've overstayed their welcome. They should go, you know? You know, she's really a tough case.
My friend that I did watch this episode with, as I am, as you are, is like a big Game of Thrones fan. And she was like, oh, this is like the scene that Cersei has. And I think it's like season 4 or 5. I can't remember, where she says, Littlefinger, I think, says to her, like, knowledge is power. And she goes, no, power is power. And like all of her guards just like step forward. And like, she's like, oh, my friend was like, oh, this is like her power is power moment, where she just like activates Alan. She's like, tell her how you feel about it, Alan. Like, go do my dirty work. It doesn't necessarily work out for her, but like, that's her intention. So, and then we get, you know, some more invasive detecting from Dick, as he goes to the hospital. where Camille, the rehab center where Camille checked in. And, I don't know if you had the same reaction I did. Like, he walks in, it's the same, I guess there's only like one nurse whoever works at that front desk and she's there.
Yeah. And no, it's actually triplets. They all got a job.
It's like a hot fuzz. So you know where he is. He's at the facility where Camille was, and that is so invasive. And then he goes to like talk to a physician there about the mindset of someone who would check themselves in there. And it's just all bad moves from Dick, and, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And obviously he knows, because I think she wasn't there, that she didn't commit these crimes that he's investigating. Right. But like, as he said earlier, like, he really thinks that she has something to do with them. And it's creepy the way that he can both, I think, be pretty earnest about pasta in bed, but then also be doing this stuff on the side. I mean, Camille, I guess, is much the same way, it's just interesting that they're both playing each other while also falling for each other, which is not an unfamiliar dynamic in detective stories, but this show does it a bit
differently.
It's true.
I'm not convinced that he, like, definitely believes that she has something to do with it. I think he's like, just in case she does or something. You know what I mean? Like, because, Vickery keeps warning him about her, and Adora warns him about her. And so he's like, okay, to protect myself, maybe I should find out about her. But I also think it's just sort of like, it's like the extreme version of like, digging through someone's Facebook profile when you first start dating them. You know what I mean? To like, find out as much information, you know, not that I've ever done that, to find out as much information as possible about them. I don't know, it's just a terrible abuse of power as far as I'm concerned. And then we have, Camille listening to the Ashley tape. So this is something, I think this is the last time I'll bring up this Alan Sepinwall interview, but like, this is something that Jean-Marc Vallée said to Alan Sepinwall that I think I must have processed, but maybe not fully, which is that every time they cut to the past, you still hear the present. So you're listening to the present while you're in the past. So even when it's like, even when there's like flashbacks to dialogue, you still hear whatever it is Camille is doing in the present in the background of the sound mix. Which is something that I just hadn't really fully latched onto until you have this great shot of like, you see Ashley talking, but what you hear is the tape that Camille is listening to. It's very eerie and really effective, and I really liked it. What did you think of that?
Yeah, no, I think that I was hip to it before, but like, something about this particular episode just really drove home that like, I think that Vallée is doing a brilliant job. Like, I think this is like top level work, like, and it's because it's so thought through in every tiny, tiny detail. And yet manages to seem not overly mannered and just like really fluid. And I think it's some of the best depictions of kind of waking dreams and like sort of, you know, daydream reverie kind of, memory stuff that I've ever seen. Like, it's just, it mimics the rhythms of that and the kind of levels, the kind of drift between past and present, like, so well in such an inventive, you know, cinematic way. That, yeah, it's just really stunning.
We get this curry call in this episode that is, that made me laugh. Another like journalism moment when she's like, can you even like use your family as a source? And Curry's like, they're called anonymous sources. And I was like, And we get, Curry's wife on the phone and stuff like that. And it's just, it underlines, I guess, that Camille still doesn't know that Curry's sick, that he's home from work, but he won't tell her why. And, and that his wife has a sort of motherly concern for Camille as well. So, and then in contrast, we get Alan talking to Camille. So this is there's a very similar scene in the book, without the lead up that we get in the show of like, Adora telling Alan he needs to tell Camille to leave. It's just Alan telling Camille to leave in the book, and it always like really stood out to me as very odd. So I'm glad we have this other like packaging around it. I also couldn't reconcile, knowing that that scene happened in the book, Alan telling Camille like she's making her mother sick and she has to go, with the Alan that we meet in the show, who like got a birthday cake for young Camille and stuff like that, and like makes these sort of feeble attempts to be some kind of half-assed father to her. And so I think it's just positions Alan as super weak, unwilling to take a stand on either side, which we already knew about him. But I really like Amy Adams' whole body language for this, where she's just like leaning over the railing and kind of barely looking at him as he's like lobbing all this shit at her. What did you think of this?
Yeah, it's crazy seeing him, you know, because he's been this kind of like passive sort of like, you know, helpmeet to Adora, and he still is being that, but like he's a fucking asshole too, and you'd have to be, I guess, to tolerate it. And this thing about standing over the house like a witch and like he's got some poetry to him,
right?
But it's in service of like just towing, like carrying water for Adora, who is made, you know. We don't know the full extent to it, really, but like we're six episodes in, we've figured out that like Adora was a big part of the reason why Camille is the way she is, you know, you know, for him to just, and he's known her since she was little. I don't know. It actually made me appreciate more the goofier aspects of Alan, because I kind of almost feel like it was the show setting us up to think he was sort of harmless. But of course he's an enabler and, you know, is complicit. And, here he is kind of, enacting that complicity, in a more active way.
Yeah. I think that, whenever you have an abusive mother figure like that, like you can't have that abusive mother figure without a complicit father figure. I mean, presuming heteronormativity in like a two parent household and all that sort of stuff. Like the abusive mother trope is so frequently explored, but this like passive complicit father trope, I think it's really good that the show has room for that as well with Alan. So, And this mention of like, I mean, him choosing his own comfort, right? It's more comfort, like his life will be easier if Adora is happy. So this is an act of self comfort. I will do this and further hurt this child and further hurt her. I know she's a grown person, but like she's his child in a way, like, and say really toxic thing about like, oh, you're just like your grandmother, you know, like, and it's so funny because usually that terrible insult is like, you're just like your mother, right? But like he can't do that. So he's like, you're just like your grandmother who was a terrible person and would like pinch babies and stuff like that. Yeah, is all about his own comfort, and it's pretty monstrous in its own right. So, but then like the mood is sharply lightened by the entrance of Angie. Angie and the other like grown-up cheerleaders are all their own venomous things, but like at least Angie comes with like a center console that has bourbon in it. Like the whole everything with the bourbon, delightful. Like Angie travels with bourbon, has a whole lecture about the kind of ice cubes, has like a plastic to-go cup ready. Like I'm thinking this is how I should pick up people from now on for the plastic to-go cup. What do you think?
Yeah, and I don't know if the actress is Lauren September. I don't know if she practiced it, but she opens the center console and like pulls out the thing with such this kind of like practice, like rhythm. It's really funny. She's like, it's very smooth about it.
Yeah. She like doesn't even look I think as she like proffers the bottle the second time. She's like, here you go, darling. I like to think that Lauren September like sat in a car and just practiced that move over and over again until she perfected it. So good.
It's really great. And I think, you know, this scene with all the former cheerleaders, like every actor on this show is like doing it fully, you know, like everyone's committed. Everyone has their own little thing without, you know, sort of overplaying anything. And I just think that it's the sign of a great cast of actors and a good director who knows how to calibrate all that. Another thing about this scene that I thought was a nice little detail was when Camille goes for the second drink, that kind of like woohoo good time thing like kind of dissipates, and Angie like kind of looks at her a little bit askew, even though she offered it,
right?
You know, so it's kind of like these girls are, or these women are forever setting up Camille to sort of not disappoint them exactly, but sort of give them a reason to cluck their tongues. And so they provide the opportunity for Camille
to
do
that. Well, forever setting up everyone, you know, like, so like Angie immediately starts talking like venomous shit on all the women that they're about to go see, right? And like, And then later when, you know, they're all there and they're crying over Beaches and then they like crying over their lives. And Angie says to, I think the character's Gretchen, she's like, you can tell us you're among friends. And you're like, no, you're just gathering more ammunition for the next time you take a drive and want to talk like spit shit on someone. Like you like you're laying a trap and every single one of these women just like keeps walking into each other and they all certainly talk shit on each other. And it's just like their lives. I love, a few things about like the interior of the Lacey home. Like Camille walking in and taking it in, you know, like, Angie says they roll up, like imagine the house you could have had if you had stayed here. So like Katie Lacey's house is something to be admired, but Camille sort of looks around and I'm like with her that this is like a boring, yeah, basic suburban rich. You know what I mean? Like the kitchen is just like, here's the double oven. Here's her, like her like Pinterest inspired apps that she's put out, you know, like all this sort of stuff is like, isn't this what you're supposed to want? Or isn't this what you should have had as the most beautiful girl in Wind Gap? But she's like, this is not what I want. Or is it? No, it's not. You know what I mean? Like, and then the other thing that I really like is there's this just tiny moment of like, you know, Camille and Becca escape. They're sitting outside. Camille's smoking. The other girls come out in this sort of like, how you don't walk away from us, we walk away from you sort of moment. And then Gretchen, like two of the women like sit on the chair and Gretchen sort of like precariously perches herself on the other chair and looks just like it's so awkward and studied and like self-conscious, and it's just a tiny silent physical thing that I really enjoyed. So
yeah, there are a lot of good little details like that in this sequence. It's funny, my brain is fully broken because I've been watching so much Love Island recently. And that whole show is basically them just like moving around this porch, you know, from one spot to another in kind of arbitrary groupings, just having kind of nothing conversations. It's mesmerizing. But this made me think of that. It was like a very like strong Love Island thing where they're like, now we're talking outside, right. You know, for no other reason than like it's somewhere new. And also that's where Camille is. I like the line that Becca has where she says like, I can't quote it directly, but something along the lines of, I didn't know how miserable my life was until I started coming to these things. Yeah. I just think that's a pretty funny thing. And again, it's Becca in a very kind and friendly and generous way, kind of telling Camille like, yeah, you know, like I see you got it bad and I sympathize with you, but like also, you know, right. I'm here too.
Right. And this scene, which I loved so much in the books, which is like these women inviting Camille in and then like turning on her, is what I had in mind when in the very first episode, I wanted to make sure to point out that like as soon as Camille gets to town, like the first question she's asked by Vickery's like secretary or whatever is like, do you have kids? And this question over and over again of like, do you have kids? And you're not like, you know, like even Angie in the car, I swear Angie already knows that Camille doesn't have a husband and doesn't have a boyfriend and like asks her again anyway. And like the way in which these four women talk about this is so real. Like I have a lot of friends who are young moms and they do it in like a less venomous way, but there is such a real conflict between women who are mothers and women who aren't. And my unified, I have a lot of sympathy for both sides of it. Like I don't think no one's as like terrible as these women about it, but like I think if you're a mother, which is so hard because you have like no sleep and your entire life is consumed by this project, I think it is both an important and emotionally validating thing to do on its face, but also like you need it to be important and emotionally validating, or else why are you doing this thing that's so hard? And I think that fuels, right. Sometimes fuels this whole like, well, you're not a full person until you've had a child, or you don't know what love is until you've had a child, which is like a pretty venomous thing to say to someone, but is something that I've seen mothers say, quite often. And, you know, not always intending to be venomous, but like, it is just this whole, like, you're not really living a full life until you've done this. And I like that Camille sticks up for herself. And of course, I love her little snide, like, girl power clink of the glass to Becca. It's pretty solid. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we get this, as we mentioned at the top of the episode, per the email that we got, this interaction between Kirk and Camille. What did you think of this? I thought it was interesting.
I guess in a way I didn't quite buy the, like, I snuck back into the house to have this conversation with you right now.
Sure.
Like, I was like, there are, like, maybe easier ways. Like, he knows she's at that bar all the goddamn time. Like, flag her down there. But that said, I think that the nuance between their points of view on the matter, where he's, like, racked with guilt, he's thought about it, you know, every day since, really believes he's done something terrible, and Camille, being, I don't know how to put it exactly, but I guess really put off by the fact that he sort of is viewing her as this, like, victim of something he mm-hmm. did, and thus, in a way, kind of making her thing his part of his narrative. Yeah. You know, he's, like, sort of, like, in the way that men do a lot, like, taking ownership of this thing, as a means for, you know, he's begging for her forgiveness or whatever, and she's like, fuck off, dude, like, I don't care. You know, like, I'm fine, it happened, it was whatever it was. It, you know, if I can recall, you couldn't even get hard, so we both got fucked or whatever, you know, like, she's, and I don't think it's all just, like, an act. I think that she really believes it and feels pretty, like, accosted by all this kind of, you know, retroactive guilt on the part of this boy or this now man.
Yeah. And I think we see a similar setup with the Becca conversation later, where Becca's like, I saw that you were cutting. And like the way in which Camille, and it's similar to like whatever tenderness Dick was trying to offer her in the first scene, like she can't be vulnerable. She can't put herself in a position to be vulnerable. So to accept Kirk's apology is to accept a narrative where she's a victim, and she can't do that because any vulnerability from her is like a way in which Adora would find a way to like stab at her. You know what I mean? So she has to like keep these defenses up. So when, she's both telling the truth and lying, as our listener email said, like sort of both, because when she's like, forget about it, I have, we know she hasn't. Like we've seen her flash to it. We know she hasn't forgotten about it. Like maybe she's thinking about it more since she's gotten back into town, but like it's not like she's forgotten about it or that it doesn't matter to her. We know it does.
Right.
But at the same time, I think you're right in terms of like she's convinced herself that she needs to not have been a victim in that moment. And, she's convinced herself so much that that's a truth for her as well. And so she's like, fuck you for apologizing to me, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah. And also like, I mean, you know, I don't want to speak for people who have been in these positions. And I'm sure there's a whole panoply of reactions and to this kind of trauma, but like, I think also her repulsion with this is just like, I don't want to have to consider how you feel about this.
Yeah.
Like I have too much, you know, going on in my own head about it. And like, you're now putting the onus of your guilt on me too. Now too, you know, yeah. Like just, you know, in a way, I think that she's not saying that what happened in the past doesn't matter, but it doesn't matter now what he thinks to her, you know?
Yeah.
She's like, go do your thing. Like I'm good. Even though she's not good.
I completely agree. Speaking of that bar where she hangs out all the time, I sort of, slammed a few scenes together about this, like, Dick and Jackie encounter the bar. That here we get, like, nighttime Jackie, drunk Jackie, a different caftan, same great.
A real tour de force of drunk acting by Elizabeth Perkins. Drunk acting is hard to do well. Very few actors can do it, convincingly, and I think she nailed it.
This cut, cause like, it's not the first cut, it's the second cut, but this cut back to her where she's like in mid-sentence and she's like, she's saying the sentence, perky little titty shining in the sun, and sort of, oh my God, it's like the best thing I've ever seen. Something that she said to you, I loved the interview that you did with her, and something that she said to you, I think, was like, that, you know, what Jean-Marc Vallée will do is film a whole scene, but then like cut it up, and so, you know, cut to something in the middle of a scene that they shot, you know, so presumably she had a whole run-up of something else to that, but he's like, we're gonna cut in on perky little titty shining in the sun, and I think it was an excellent choice. It's so good. So
another evocation of Cherries too. Yes, in a way,
absolutely. But, you know, so Dick is like fishing for information, and as plastered as Jackie is, she's still like aware and sharp, and she's like, you know, you're you clearly want to know something. What do you want to know? And he asks why Camille was self-harming, and she talks about Marion dying, Marion being a sickly child, that there was no autopsy. And then Dick in exchange tells her about Alice, which Jackie didn't know about. And that's where Jackie says, the thesis of the show, which is dead girls everywhere. What did you think of this little exchange?
I think it's a marvelous piece of acting on Elizabeth Perkins' part. I'm glad that Jackie is clicking into the story a little bit more. I mean, maybe this was her big episode. I don't know. But, like, it's interesting to see a little bit more of a pathetic side of Jackie, where she's kind of hitting on him and it's not working. And she has this sadness about her, and yet still has her faculties. You know, she's, like, still, aware enough to be guarded about information and about, you know, history. And I think that that's a lot of stuff to play. And Perkins, while also being drunk, you know, the nuances of being drunk, I think she does very well.
It's really good. And then we cut back to Becca and Camille, and we get the secondary source on the name of the episode, which is Cherry, where Becca talks about. So, like, you really liked the scene. It's so funny. I thought this was a little too on, like, this is the first time I felt like the words were a little too on the nose. I think Hilary Ward delivered this really well, the actress who plays Becca, but, you know, she talks about, you know, we were shiny and luscious on the inside, outside, inside hard, a hard, dark pit, which just to me felt like a little too, like, let me explain to you how we were cherries. What did you think?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's on the nose for sure. Yeah. But, you know, I think in this, that in that hog heap, people are, you know, prone to a little kind of heavy poetry, a little purpleness, from time to time. And I think that what precedes that sort of metaphorical or allegorical talk, is interesting. And I just like that they gave Becca a moment, you know. I think that that's a credit to the show, that they give all these characters little moments and humanity.
All right. And then, you know, Camille does, well, we get Adora, like, asking Alan why he didn't, you know, deliver her request. And Alan, I mean, stands up to her, but doesn't, and just says, like, you were always better with the girls. Like, that's a little bit of a fuck you. I don't know. These weird moments where, like that scene a couple episodes ago where Alan, like, comes into Adora's room and, like, takes her. Like, you know, these, like, weird, Alan does have a spine, but then he doesn't. So I don't know. And I did you see what Alan was reading with a magnifying glass?
It looked like he was looking at a dictionary.
It was a weird dictionary. For a second, I thought it might be like the Merck manual. I don't know. It was like, cause it was like a grid. Anyway, Alan.
These are high class problems because on this, our screening site, when you pause it,
it's
fuzzy,
like super blurry
because they don't want people taking screenshots.
So if you guys are like, it's clear as day that it's this is why we're having trouble seeing what it is. If you want to,
the price of being
if
fancy.
If you want to tweet at us or email us and let us know what you think it is, that Alan's reading. But, then we get Camille doing her favorite activity, which is buying vodka. This episode has so much stuff in it. Like it's crazy to me that like Camille goes and interviews John Keane and then goes to, Katie Lacey's house and then goes to this party. And like, those are all things that happened in the book that I was like, oh, surely we're cutting some of that because we only have 3 episodes left. Nope. We're doing it all. And there's this, you know, there's this moment where Camille's buying her vodka and, the girls come up. And did you ever see the 1980s movie Return to Oz with Fairuza Balk?
Oh, and the, what is her name? The witch? Ozma or something?
Mombi. Well, Ozma and Mombi.
Mombi. Thank you. Mombi. Yeah. No, of course. Yeah.
And they've got these creepy wheeler characters. There are these like, these things with like 4 wheels. I was like, you know, the girls have always been a little menacing to me on their roller skates, but like when they roll up to the thing and they're like rattling the cage on the outside of the window, they're either like wheelers from Return to Oz or they're like vampires who haven't been invited in. You know what I mean? They're just like, or like warriors come out and play. Like there's just something so menacing about these youths.
And speaking of good, like drunk, fucked up acting, like Eliza Scanlon is so good in this stretch of the episode, like modulating the perfect nuances of like her sort of impetuousness, like her lowered inhibitions while still maintaining her social control, while still following these emotional impulses. Like it's a really tricky thing to play this extended long nighttime sequence, that brings us to the end of the episode without hitting a false note, especially for a young performer. And like, she just gets it so fluidly that it's really incredible.
She's amazing in this. I think she's so good. And like this, you know, they hop in the car, they sort of like, abduct Camille in a way. But she like makes terrible choices all throughout, takes an oxy from her sister, later takes some oxy from her sister. This sequence in the book terrified me. Cause like Camille felt so on the verge of like, she's like, all these bad decisions. And there's also, and like, thankfully, like Eliza talked to me about this in the interview we'll get to in a little bit. But like, in the book reading it, I was like, is Camille gonna have sex with her sister? Like, I felt like such a weirdo mm-hmm. for thinking that, but like, that's what I was thinking when I was reading the book. I was like, Emma says this in the episode that she doesn't know how to relate to women, and all she knows how to do is like control men sexually, and that's the only way she knows how to like relate to people. And so she's kind of trying to do that with Camille, is like she's very sexual with her sister, and it's frankly disturbing. And like the scene where she kisses her and gives her the ecstasy is like the most explicit version of that, but it like throughout it's there. And I felt validated that it was so heavily there in the episode, because I'm like, okay, I wasn't the only one who read the book and was like, what's happening here? Yeah. What did you think of all of this?
I mean, it's, you know, that sexual danger, that sexual tension that I think is so interestingly mirrored with the earlier scene by the pool.
Yeah.
Where Emma is doing some tempting and John is not taking it. And then bizarrely her sister sort of is. Yeah. You know, later in the episode and all that talk of control and whatnot. I think that's all pretty risky, but also handled without any sort of leering, you know, sensationalism. I also think just on the technical merits once again, this is like the best stage party sequence since American Vandal.
I was going to bring up American Vandal. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it just has this like ramble to it that is so believable and so familiar to high school parties that I went to, and just that they had this kind of messy chaos to them, but nothing was too extraordinary. Nothing was too over the top. You know, it was just like sweaty, drunk kids just like crashing into each other, you know, and being mean in a way that alcohol allowed them to be, and being sexual in a way that alcohol allowed them to be, and other drugs, you know. I just think it was pitched exactly right.
I don't know why like a few of the boys are wearing ties, but I really like that aspect too, because it's just sort of like, you know, like Ashley coming from cheer practice, like these boys were like at some function where they had to wear ties and now they're at parties like just being high school animals. The American Vandal thing you bring up, as you know, we did a very important oral history of the Nana's party over on VF.com for American Vandal. And what they said is because of the way they shot that, which was for American Vandal, they shot that party scene like entirely on iPhones. The party had to be going around them at all times. It's not just like you're shooting from one direction and there's nothing behind you. It's like an actual party going. And the same is true, you know, Eliza confirmed that the same is true of like Jean-Marc Vallée. All of his actors have said, like, you never know where his camera's pointing. You never know what he's shooting. You never know what he's doing. And so that just means that that party had to just be like going. But Eliza said, but we didn't have any music. So we were just like pretending that there was music the whole time, which is pretty, pretty amazing. So we get Ashley and John show up. And, you know, Camille asks Ashley about the bite in her ear, and Ashley's like, you know, really pissed that she's not in the paper again. And then she says, you should ask your mom if you want to know about Natalie. And she has this great parting shot where she's like, no one reads the paper anymore anyway. And I was like, that's right, dude. No one reads the paper. These children wouldn't care.
Joanna, we're supposed to be defending the integrity of print media.
But paper is important.
Especially magazines, monthly periodicals.
Really fair. But the, and John and Ashley showed up because Ashley, like, she was like, we won't be pariahs or whatever. We won't be outcasts, something like that. But they quickly are sort of jeered out of the party. Then you get the, like, rolling roulette, as they call it, with, Camille taking the ecstasy. I like this, like, the cut back. We find out that she did take the oxy. Now she's on oxy and, ecstasy.
I kept waiting to hear Rolling with My Homies because they were basically doing suck and blow.
I mean, it was very suck and blow. And then speaking of 90s or early aughts teen comedies, we get the classic 10 Things I Hate About You. Obviously, it's not from that movie, but we get this musical moment from Emma and her girls of Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, the Frankie Valli song. And Emma has very interesting... musical taste for a teen in 2018, with her Tupac and her Frankie Valli. So, you know, the girls do their like little routine to this. And it's just like a really, like that song has very positive associations for me. I do think of like Heath Ledger serenading Julia Stiles. And so like, it just was more ominous this time than I've ever seen it before. So I don't know.
Yeah.
And then we get the nighttime skate, which Eliza was very graciously talked to me about. The way in which they almost, in my opinion, almost pull off making it look like Amy Adams is skating, but she's definitely not skating. And, you know, the skate home. And there's this great sound cut in this where, like, the Frankie Valli song is still kind of going. And the train sort of honk of the train is to the beat of the song. It's amazing. This whole like drug fueled skate home and then their last conversation sort of on the lawn here. What did you think of the night skate and like this sisterly conversation?
I know my role this episode has just been like, gee, isn't the show good? But like, isn't this show good? Like this whole sequence, like, not that I have ever done this, but I would imagine is like exactly what almost the end of that, like, fucked up night feels like. Like, the rhythms of it, the kind of, like, hazy, like, where are we? What are we doing? Oh, right. We're the, you know, like, there not being a sense of border to your world and in your body even. And time feels sort of malleable. It's very, I think, accurate to, one of the good nights, you know, when you've indulged. And because it's really not even clear in a way, like, obviously the stuff about controlling boys is stated, you know, matter-of-factly by Emma. But, like, every other sort of emotion and sort of spoken or unspoken sentiment kind of tumbling between them until the end of the episode, it's kind of vaguely, you're not really sure what it's about. They're just kind of, like, feeling each other. Like, they're just, like, vibing together.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe for the first genuine time, even though they're on drugs. And then the episode just kind of ends. You know, like it's pretty interesting. Oh, well, there's another detail, obviously, separate of them. But like, I don't know. I just love the kind of energy this episode goes out.
Yeah. And maybe like, this is what, I mean, you know, Camille is forever self-medicating with vodka and stuff like that. But like the ecstasy really it breaks down these barriers that she's holding up, for Kirk, for Dick, for Becca, like in this episode, like Emma gets through because of the drugs, I would say. That's like what it took to get Camille to drop her guard. And
yeah, this is like overwrought, but like, it's kind of almost like the town possessed them. Like they're kind of like in this like crucible fit. You know, this witchy kind of ecstasy.
Yeah.
I mean, cause that's the name of the drug, but like, you know what I mean? Like a religious ecstasy or something, an old timey ecstasy. And it's creepy, but it's also like kind of sweet in a way.
And it's just so seductive for Camille to like have a sister figure again when like the loss of Marion, the loss of like her one ally in that house is like the most painful origin story for her. And so to have this other girl offer to fill that role for her is so seductive to her. And like the way in which she like twirls her around and sees her and sees Marion and sees the other dead girls, And then you get this, like, them sneaking into the house. I love the moment where they, like, go over the, like, I didn't get it the first time why they were going over the railing, but it was so they wouldn't have to, like, creep past Adora's door, which is, like, so obviously, like, an old Camille trick that she's teaching her sister. And that's such, like, a sister thing to do.
Yeah.
Totally. I love it.
They're not very subtle about it. They're pretty loud, but still, yeah, it's funny. I mean, that they try.
Yeah, they try. Adora definitely knows they're there. Adora probably knows they're there because she heard them, but also because, like, Vickery spots them skating down the street, and Vickery's such a fucking tattletale. So I'm sure he called her and was like, your girls are skating home, like, drunk and high. We should also mention, that according to Vickery, you know, someone on the hog farm, a Mexican on the hog farm, ID'd John Keane as the person who put the bike in the muck.
Yeah.
And
isn't it interesting that we keep hearing about these Mexicans, but I don't think we've ever seen one? Maybe in a scene on the farm.
Maybe one, like, told, like, John Keane to go home, but yeah.
But, like, beyond that, I think that's very deliberate.
It's an other racial aspect of the show, right? This, like, other Mexican vague threat.
And a big aspect of, like, the politics of our actual real country,
1,000%. Yeah, absolutely.
In rural communities.
And then, the last thing we should mention is that, like, for the first time, I would say, like, the ghosts that, you know, Camille has been seeing, like, really start interacting back with her. And so the ghost of Marion is sort of holding her hand as she's passed out in bed with Emma. And Marion says, it's not safe for you here. Which is very chilling. And then the episode ends.
Did it kind of look like the ghost of Marion didn't have any teeth?
Oh, I should rewatch. I didn't notice it. I will say that, like,
it might just have been the light, but I was like, oh, maybe.
I will say that, like, Marion, without, like, is harder to recognize without her pigtails. I don't know. Like, there's different stages of Marion, I think. I don't know. But, like, the way in which she was, like, watching them, like, I really like the first shot of her watching them from below in the staircase. I really love, because it was like, it felt like a very sad and lonely, like, that used to be my thing that I did with my sister, like, sad, lonely ghost thing. But then, like, the warning ghost that she becomes, I don't know. It's fascinating. And, like, it's spooky and supernatural in a way that the book never quite becomes. And, I know we've talked so much about, like, the great work that the show has done to be, like, subjectively in Camille's head, but I always thought that the ghosts would just sort of stay there as, like, things that she's thinking about. And so for this ghost to reach out and take her hand and tell her it's not safe for her is an interesting new wrinkle. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even if it means that Camille was already asleep.
Right.
And dreaming again. Sure. But, like, it's a really striking, and then the episode just cuts right out.
All right. Well, that's the end of the episode proper, but we are going to, before we hit our spoiler section, we are going to go to our interview with Eliza Scanlon. Like I said elsewhere, just because she has an Australian accent does not mean this is not the real Emma, because, the actress is Australian. So here she is, the great Eliza Scanlon.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration. A kitchen with no space. A toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Hello. Hi.
I just wanted to let you know, I don't know if this has sort of made it into your view at all, but a bunch of people that I know who are watching the show have made like a drinking game out of every time that Emma says, shut up, Jodes, or shut the fuck up, Jodes.
No, I haven't heard of that, but I want to play it.
Right? It's become one of my favorite elements of everything. So take a drink every time.
I thought you were going to say every time Camille drinks.
Oh, no. Then you die. Then you're dead. So
there you go.
I love your performance so much on the show. I want to like just start by asking you about the duality of the roles you have to play. I read somewhere that you modulated your voice to be a little different depending whether you're playing like good girl Emma or bad girl Emma. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, I worked with a dialect coach a few months earlier before we started shooting, and she actually came on as the dialect coach for the whole cast. And we had so much fun kind of creating the voices together. And I think naturally when I was playing the more goody-goody side of Emma, I felt like the pitch of my voice changed a little bit. It became a little bit higher, and so we kind of attached that to that side of her character, and that became the way I kind of navigated that side. And then for the more rebellious side, it was a bit of a lower, more... I guess a bit more sexualized and deep set. And I think that added to this kind of intensity about Anna when she's out with her friends and she's being a bit rebellious and doing things that she probably shouldn't be doing. There's this kind of dangerous quality about the voice, which helped me really get into the space. But yeah, I never thought that it would help me so much. But yeah, that was one of the things that I really enjoyed creating for Emma, because I guess so much of it is already there because it's a book. And yeah, that was really cool to have agency over that part of the character.
When I was talking to Gillian a couple weeks ago, she reminded me of this part from the book where that we haven't gotten to yet, where Emma talks about Persephone, this idea of like a mythological figure that splits time between the underworld and, you know, at home with her mother. Mm-hmm. I was wondering when she reminded me of that, then I started noticing all the red lighting that's on Emma, like specifically in this episode in the party scene. There's all this red lighting on her when she's sort of in her, as you say, like rebellious persona. Was that an intentional choice that you remember, or is that a coincidence?
No, I never even saw it in that way. But I guess that's the cool thing when you do look back on it, you kind of notice things that you never really expected. And John Mark has put so much thought and detail into the show, and that kind of awareness that Emma has of those historical figures, I found was really interesting. It's not, and it makes me wonder whether Emma's decision to have this dual personality is somewhat influenced by, I don't know, her interest in historical figures. It's not something that's just a result of her being an immature kind of teenager. It's kind of calculated, and she sees this strength and nobility in being able to kind of oscillate between the two. And I guess she saw that in Persephone and maybe wanted to kind of translate it into her own life. And but yeah, that party scene, I'm excited for everyone to watch it, because that's one of my favorite episodes. But yeah, I never even thought about that. That's really cool.
Well, I was really looking forward to the party scene as well, because it was actually, in all the murder and all the, like, everything that happens in the book, that party scene, I think, actually stressed me out the most, because you're just watching Camille make these terrible decisions and you're so worried for her.
I know
I know that John Mark has this, like roving camera thing he does where he just sort of like has to have the action going around all the time and you never know where the camera's pointing. So did you guys just have to have like a full-fledged party going like 360 around the camera at all time as you filmed this particular episode?
Well, yeah, basically, but it was like it was a party with no music, because as you know, whenever you shoot like party scenes or scenes with music, they never actually have it. So we were all dancing to nothing, basically. So that was interesting. but yeah, there was a lot of stuff that ended up being cut out of the final cut. Jean-Marc, he made April Violet, who played Kelsey and Jodes, and I. He made us learn this dance called the chicken dance, and I can't remember where it came from, but he saw it somewhere on YouTube, and I think it must have been a dance that originated from the South in like the 50s. But it was this, it's kind of reminds me of the Nutbush a little bit. And he made us do the whole thing, and it was so strange, but I loved it. And we did a lot for that. For that party scene, that you know, a lot of it got cut out, but it did have this party feel to it doing it, because yeah, you had to be in it the whole time. So yeah, I guess that there is a lot of advantages to the way that Jean-Marc films, because you kind of have to be in it, otherwise people smell bullshit straight away. So he has a very good bullshit radar, which I love.
Well, in a recent interview, he mentioned that he considers Camille and Alan and Emma to be like the three DJs of the series, that Emma is one of the people that provides the music. And in this episode, you know, like you got to do your Tupac moment earlier, which was great. But in this episode, you've got this great can't take my eyes off of you sort of sequence.
Yeah.
What was it like filming that? And like, what do you think about the music that Emma, you know, a teenager in 2018 is interested in, like this older music? What do you think that means?
That's one of the really exciting things about working with Jean-Marc, is that he's always got so many ideas about the music, and for him, music is such a big part of the atmosphere of the show. And I remember when he was telling me that he wanted me to learn the lyrics to that song, Can't Take My Eyes Off You, he said, we want to take this song and make it unique for our TV show, because, you know, it's been in so many films, like 10 Things I Hate About You and lots of other movies. So he kind of wanted to take it for his own and make it new and fresh. And it was really funny. But yeah, I think having a playlist or some kind of understanding of the music that characters listen to is really helpful. I found that before I was going into scenes, I listened to some of the music that Jean-Marc had recommended to me, and it was a really interesting way of kind of getting into the world of the character. I think music has an incredible just natural ability to do that and to bring you into a certain world. And yeah, I think I love how Jean-Marc is just so open to every type of genre. And yeah, I think that last scene, the scene from last week with Tupac was really cool. And I love that Anna is kind of, well, like Jean-Marc, open to different genres of music. And I think it adds another layer to the show for sure. But yeah, I'm excited to hear what other music he's put in it.
Are there any songs that you remember him recommending to you as like Emma songs that maybe didn't make it into the show itself?
He did. I remember him recommending some D12. I'm not complaining about it. I like D12. what else did he recommend? Lots of Led Zeppelin.
Right.
Which ended up going in the show. But yeah, he never got around to giving me the playlist. He always said it every day. He was like, "I'm gonna get it to you. I'm gonna get it to you, Eliza." But he never did. I'm still waiting.
I think one of the reasons that the party scene stressed me out so much in the book is there's this unsettling sort of sexual connection between Emma and Camille that I think bears out, you know, it made me feel like less of a weirdo that that was my interpretation when I saw the episode, because I'm like, oh no, that's in the episode too. Okay, great. But like Emma talks so much in this episode, like, I don't know, both you see it in the pool scene with John Keane, and both she talks about it, about she knows how to interact with men because that's about sexual control, and she doesn't know how to interact with women. She feels like they hate her. She doesn't know how to connect with them. Do you feel like she's approaching Camille like trying to use that sexual control that she knows that she's comfortable with, like with her, to connect with her sister, or what do you feel like is going on with Emma trying to connect with Camille in this scene?
It's really interesting. I think that growing up the way that she has, in some ways, she has a very warped sense of what love is and what care is. And I think somewhere in this episode, well, somewhere in this kind of drug trip sort of thing, she's kind of mistaken a platonic or sisterly love for a more sexual kind of approach to it. And I think she's a little confused. And like so many teenagers, I think you experience things for the first time and it's all very confusing, and you're kind of trying to discern, you're trying to figure out how to deal with these emotions. And I think part of that is trying to discern between this kind of sexual attraction, or is it a platonic attraction? And I think combined with the drugs, she's probably a little confused. And I think for Emma, yeah, like you said, it's so much about control, and she always needs to be in control to be sure of herself. And in this circumstance, I think she's sexually fueled, and she wants to have a good time, and she'll do whatever it takes. But yeah, it's a very interesting dynamic, and you see that definitely unfold in this episode.
I'm completely obsessed with the skating on this show, which, you know, was not in the book, something Jean-Marc Vallée decided to add to the show. Were you already a professional skater, or did you like curse Jean-Marc Vallée and be like, why did you make me do this on top of everything else for the show?
I had never roller skated before in my life.
No.
So I was already so stressed out about the role as it was. And then he told us that we needed to roller skate. And the video that he sent us for a reference was, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's Chet Faker, his music video for his song Gold. It features three roller skaters who are professional roller skaters, mind you, roller skating down this freeway, this empty freeway, and doing the craziest tricks I think I've ever seen. And they look so beautiful and sexy and just gorgeous roller skating. And that was his reference for us. And I don't think he realized how scary it felt to learn how to roller skate after watching that video, because I had this expectation that he wanted us to be as good as those girls who have been probably roller skating their whole life. That really got me into order, and I was roller skating every day up until the shoot. And we had a roller skating coach who we were working with most days to kind of keep us in order. And yeah, I mean, I like roller skating now, but I sure as hell didn't like it in the beginning. I was really not good at it.
Did you get like a lot of bruises, were there a lot of falls like as you were beginning?
Yeah, we had to wear knee pads and wrist pads, and because we were in the sun so much, I got really funny looking tans.
this episode has this amazing nightscape with like this drug trance nightscape with you and Amy. I don't think Amy is skating in this. It looks like she is maybe being sort of like pulled on something.
Well, they actually used the Patriot car to where the whole crew would sit on and shoot the scene. And they somehow created this platform that sat on the back of the car, which Amy sat on, and she was strapped into it and she was kind of harnessed into it. And so it looks like she was skating when they started moving the car, and she kind of had to sway as if she was skating. But I was definitely roller skating in the background. That was definitely real. Uh-huh. I had to skate pretty fast, and the ground was really, it wasn't laid out very well, and there were a lot of cracks. So half the time I was trying not to die. And it was probably like 1 a.m, 2 a.m. And I think by the end of it, yeah, it was that day that I had a really big fall on the roller skates because I was just so tired. I think I had the flu, and that kind of, I fell, and that sort of ended our shoot because I was just so tired. But yeah, I guess that's movie magic for you.
You're like, that's it. I'm done. I'm out. I'm like, Emma yeah. out. Emma down. All right.
down.
There's one thing I think is so interesting and maybe like a challenge for you as an actress is the series is so firmly inside Camille's head. This is Camille's like subjective point of view. And like as she's trying to figure out who Emma is, it's important then that Emma is like kind of mysterious to us. So when we get these shots of like, I'm thinking specifically of like Emma going to the hog farm and looking at the pigs, where we're trying to figure out what Emma is thinking, and maybe we as the audience are not exactly supposed to know. Like, is that stuff laid out for you in the script? Is that something that you and Jean-Marc talk about, or how much of like Emma's interior workings are you filling in? Are you discussing with Jean-Marc? Are you reading out of the script?
I do see that in the way it's been filmed, and even in the script, she was written as an enigma, especially in the earlier episodes. And it was really up to me to kind of fill in the blanks and sort of figure out a motive to why she's doing all the things that she's doing, which was really hard. I mean, it took me a long while to kind of get inside Emma's head because she's just so different to me. And I think a lot of the things that she does is hard to kind of justify or explain. And because she's so, I guess, this duality about her makes her it really difficult to kind of pinpoint a constant about her, because I don't think she really has a constant. I think her constant is being unreliable. So I don't know. I think so much of that for me was about embracing her multiple truths, and I sort of felt that she was constantly shifting between different parts of her personality, and none of them were false, but they all had a different truth to them, and she lent towards different parts of her personality for specific people. And I think that's something we all do, but I think Emma has gotten particularly and exceptionally good at that because of just the nature of her family, I think, and just the way she has been brought up. I think for Jean-Marc as a director, it's always about authenticity and following instinct. And he has such a deep respect for actors and what we do that he doesn't like to interfere too much into their process. I think for him, it's just about bringing actors outside of their comfort zone and fully embracing the unpredictable nature of the way he shoots. I didn't really talk to Jean-Marc too much about the character. I think Amy and I talked a lot about our relationship and what that meant to Camille and Emma. And I think the most helpful conversations I had was with the cast, because in the end we are the ones that really understand our own characters because we're playing them. So it was really nice to kind of discuss that with Patricia and Amy, and I think that's where I got most of my inspiration and also just confidence in playing Emma and believing that, I guess, the way I was playing it was communicating and was right. And because, yeah, I did have a lot of doubts and, just doubt because it's a book and you want to do the role justice. And, I mean, Emma's definitely probably the hardest character I've ever played.
Two of my favorite shots of you that were used in a lot of the promotion are from this episode. And the first I want to talk about is this, like, bird of prey sort of dance move that you do on the roller skate. Do you know what I'm talking about? Can you talk about, like, what you were doing in that moment that resulted in that image that, like, I think is my favorite image from the trailer and the episode itself?
That is so funny, because that was just a stupid thing I did, and Jean-Marc happened to be looking, and he was like, do it again, and I was like, oh, God. So I had to do this. The weird, like, we made up this whole dance before he kind of started rolling the camera, and I had to start on my toe stops of the roller skates and do this weird little dance on my toe stops and then start skating and then do the, I don't know, what do you even call it? It's like a bat type of dance move. But yeah, he saw me do it as I was kind of just mucking around in between takes, and he just made me do it again and again. And I think it was, in the end, I really enjoyed roller skating because it was just a place where I could be creative and no one could really tell me how to roller skate because no one else could roller skate. So I was just sort of making it up.
You're like, no, this is how it's done. I know all about it.
I'm a professional roller skater now.
The other shot is this great one of you submerging into the pool, like submerging your sort of your face into the pool. That I think is supposed to be an intentional reflection of this shot we get of young Camille in the very first episode, but it's just like a haunting image nonetheless. Like, can you talk about the setup of that shot and, you know, whether that felt like a big deal at the time or just
oh no, that was a big deal because my hair, it was, you know, it could only be wet once, so yeah, that was a one shot thing. And I remember him telling me before we did it that he asked if I had ever seen Apocalypse Now, and I said, yes. And he wanted to recreate that shot. It's that really famous shot where one of the soldiers, he comes out of the water and his face is covered with mud. And I guess he wanted to do that, but reversed. So that was a one shot thing. And it's just those little things that Jean-Marc thinks of. He gets these creative impulses that usually end up going in the final cut. And I mean, the Tupac's Dear Mama scene, that was that was an impulse idea as well. That was not in the script at all.
Oh, wow.
It's really cool to see how, I guess, his thoughts and his inspirations so beautifully kind of translate into the script and into the development of the characters. And he just has such this natural impulse and I guess understanding of the characters and how they're portrayed on screen. And it's really cool. I think this show has so many unique qualities about it, and I think that's because of Jean-Marc's just total dedication to the characters and to the craft.
Thank you again so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
All
right. So having heard Eliza Scanlon admit that she did not know how to roller skate before she got the job, I hope that you all will know that you too can be as proficient as she is on the roller skates if you put your mind to it. So I expect, Richard, for you to be skating in no time. But yeah, so that's all we're going to do in the non-spoiler section. We want to do switch to the spoiler section now. Before we get there, though, like, Richard, where can people find your work on the internet?
They can find my work on the internet at vf.com. They can find me in a backyard pool having a weird charge conversation with a shirtless teenage boy. That's what I've been doing all summer, and it's summer until September 21st. Joanna, where are you?
You can find me snacking on Ashley's other ear. That's creepy. Or at Joe Wrote This, or on vanityfair.com. And now we are going to cue up the hog noises and the Tupac and go into the spoiler section. You all appreciate it. So what did you want to say, Richard, about what spoilery thing did you want to say about cherries and spoilers?
So cherry pits, when crushed up in actually a pretty small amount and ingested, when you crush the cherry pits, it creates cyanide. And you can kill someone by eating, or yourself, by eating just like 3 crushed cherry pits. And so you think about what Adora has been doing to her children, you know, in terms of poisoning them. And then that great look on Elizabeth Perkins' face when she asks how Alice died, and Dick says she drank poison, and her face just goes like white.
Wow. I hadn't even thought about
she
that.
She knows. Yeah. I think that line was definitely there for a reason. And I definitely think that Perkins' reaction was there for a reason.
I hadn't even thought, because like when he said poison, I'm like, yeah, you know, like Windex. And I hadn't even thought about like that she would take it in this other context. Wow.
And what, you know, and it almost like Jackie thinking like, oh my God, this girl is cursed. Like Camille is cursed to be surrounded, not just by dead girls, but by poisoned girls.
So if you're joining us in the spoiler section, but have not read the book, we will just remind you that Adora, like, killed Marion, you know, by poisoning her, because of this, Munchausen by proxy sort of condition that she has. This is why I like talk of how did Marion die? Was there an autopsy, et cetera, et cetera? And then the ominous sort of, like, I think, you know, we are in the, you know, next week is the penultimate episode. So we are actually, of course, right on schedule for the suspicion to shift pretty hard to Adora. So, because that's what the book does. The suspicion shifts to Adora before we finally land on, you're in the spoiler section for a reason, right? Emma as the killer. And so, like, Adora as the, like, I mean, she did kill Marion, but like Adora, all the murders being pinned on Adora, that is sort of pushed by, Ashley saying, ask your mother about Natalie, sort of thing. And then my guess is that, like, it will be determined that Adora is responsible for dumping the bike in the muck. And my guess, that's not a book thing, but my guess is that she knows that Emma did it. And so she's covering for Emma and dumped the bike there for that reason. You know what I mean? Like, there's a,
right.
Or yeah, Emma yeah. dumped it there. I don't know. Or, and so then maybe Adora, like, paid a Mexican to say that John did it. You know what I mean? Like whoever's identifying John as having done it is wrong, because John didn't do it. So I don't know. How did that bike get there? Did Adora put it there? Did Emma put it there? Et cetera, et cetera. The other things I want to say is I was wondering how they were, because they've made Dick so likable, so much more likable, I will say, than he is in the books. I was wondering how we were going to get to the part where, like, Adora has sex with him, or Camille has sex with him, then she has sex with John Nash and he finds out, and then he, like, sort of spurns her and says shitty things about her and, like, her cutting and stuff like that. And I was like, how are we going to get there from Christmasina in, like, episode
right.
6? And I think this stuff about Dick investigating her, which I suspect she's going to find out. Like, she's going to find out that he was investigating her, and that is going to drive her away from him and maybe towards John Keane. Like, I could see that
yeah.
addition to the narrative making her move there make more sense. rather than just like an impulsive thing that she does. So,
and I like how they further with getting Curry's wife on the phone. I like how they further set the table for at the very end for her kind of like getting taken in by them.
Yeah, and this this thing of Emma saying like I want to move with you to St. Louis, like that's something that Emma does in the book as she goes with Camille back home. So you know that seems to be like something that they're headed towards. And then was there anything else that we felt like was leaning towards something?
No, I was just hung up on those cherry
picks. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. That was really striking. But yeah, I think they're more on track. You know, Jackie saying to Dick, you're getting warmer, detective, meaning like, please keep asking questions about Adora, right? Like it's so interesting, like that, Adora, like that Jackie knows about Adora and is so protective of Camille, but is still unwilling to out Adora. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that there is a limit to her protectiveness. So so there we are. I think that's it, right? Did we do it?
Yeah,
we did it. All right, well, we'll be back next week with the penultimate episode. This is the last screener we have for now, so we'll see like what will happen with the finale, but episode 7 will be back in your feeds next week.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.